Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy back in the top 25, and Georgetown still sucks week.
Georgetown does indeed still suck, but barely, based on yet another terrifying, depth-defying game between Syracuse and the Hoyas. If for nothing else, I just don't want to play them anymore because no matter how much better we are than them, we just seem to make this as interesting as possible, and it's just not fun.
Yeah, pretty much every game, I feel like, since we left the Big East, and even the last couple of years in the Big East, we're a real bear. But we got a win, which has not always been the case. I think we're now 3-4 since we switched conferences, which is not ideal against the Hoyas. So actually, no, it's not
two
and, it's 3-4 in our last seven. And yeah.
2-2 since we switched. We lost the first two and then won the second two. We lost two straight to St. John's. We lost the last one or two to Nova. And then I think we split with UConn 2-2 as well.
Yeah. And all those games have just been really difficult.
For some reason.
Yeah. We were 2-4 in our last however many, like, before this weekend. Including, but last year we got the win, which was also, I mean, it's a really, a pretty bad Georgetown team, but really struggled to it. The year before, it was the John Thompson fired year, and we lost. The year before that, we lost by 7. So, I mean, we haven't been blown out since the awful game at Georgetown the year we went to the Final Four, which we obviously got our revenge in the CJ Fair dunk game in the Big East tournament. But this has not been like a slam, like, no pun intended, this hasn't been a slam dunk win for us recently. We haven't won two straight in the series. Well, now we have, but we hadn't won two straight in the series since 11-12. We haven't won three straight in the series since 9-10, so no real dominance here. And that's kind of been even like through struggles for Georgetown, we haven't had like a long winning streak since like the late 90s, early 2000s. So yeah, I think we have kind of differing views on the future of this rivalry, but I am glad that if this was the last time we play them for a while, that we are going out on a relatively high note.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I've said this before, I said it last year, and I'll say it again this year, like, I don't necessarily think that this rivalry is much of a priority at this time. I understand, like, the vitriol is still there, and I still very much hate them, and they still even more so hate us because we make them relevant, and I think that's the key for Syracuse fans. Like, if you're really fighting for this rivalry to continue, I don't blame you for doing that. The longer it continues, and that goes for UConn too, really, the longer both of those rivalries continue, the more relevant we make them. As both programs currently stand, they don't necessarily matter that much without us being involved. This is the biggest game on the schedule for both of them in many ways. It's not at all for us. I just think that, you know, especially considering how minimally we might recruit the Connecticut area, how minimally lately we've recruited the DC area, I'd be fine playing either of them, like at MSG once a year, if we just switch them back and forth. That'd be fine. I think that would actually be a more appropriate kind of way forward for this rivalry and the Huskies rivalry, personally. Again, especially given the slog that all these games have been and the poor starts, it seems like, befall us every single time we play these teams.
Yeah, see, for me, like, I think that, obviously, like, in football, it's easy to say, like, who cares about whatever series, because we don't have, like, a really true rival in the modern sense. Like, our rivals historically were, like, Penn State, West Virginia, and Colgate. And, you know, we'll play all of them. We were obviously playing West Virginia in the bowl game, but we'll play all of them, like, once in a while. But they were never, like, such, like, dyed-in-the-wool rivalries that it really mattered as much that right. We lost those games for various reasons throughout the years. And obviously, like, Penn State hasn't been, like, an every-year thing in so long. West Virginia is a little more recent, but even then, like, we were not super worked up about it. Versus, like, the Georgetown-UConn rivalries, I think, like, are among the best rivalries in college basketball, and even when one of the teams is down, usually the opponent, because we are never, like, that down. There's a lot of vitriol. I mean, we saw it. I mean, I saw it firsthand when UConn beat us this year. Like, the UConn fans wanted that game so, so much. And obviously, it definitely means probably more to them than just to us, because we are in a big boy conference, and we get games against Duke and UNC and Louisville and Notre Dame and whoever else every year, especially compared to UConn, who
has to go to Greenville, North Carolina.
Yeah, that. They have to go out to SMU and Houston, who are, like, fine programs, but they're not, like, you know, programs that you're, you know, highlighting on your schedule every year. Georgetown's a little less of an issue, but like Georgetown, their heyday was so long ago, and so much of it was tied to the Big East that was, and not necessarily the Big East that is, even if the Big East had like a lot more success in the AAC, with Villanova mostly. But like, I think rivalries mean enough in college basketball and college sports in general that I wish there was a way where we could more feasibly keep both series going. I totally understand like the issues surrounding our scheduling and making sure that we get to the NCAAs. Obviously, we are a major benefactor of like learning how to make the system work for us in the last couple of years after being kind of, you know, failing on that part in the, you know, 07-08 seasons. But it is very disappointing that we might lose those games, even if they were getting more out of it than us, and even if you know, we were putting ourselves at risk for annoying losses like we've had in recent years. I just, like, you know, still wish that there was a feasible way to make it work in light of like the changing in the AAC scheduling, which is like the major issue here, is that we're getting another conference game, which most likely means another, you know, pretty difficult team, or at least like mid-level Power 5 team, versus playing, you know, and rather than lose a bye game or another home game against one of the mid-majors that we've done really well with in terms of finding opponents that we can beat but also help us, we're going to probably lose one of these rivalries, which is unfortunate. So we'll see. I'm not like, you know, going to start throwing things places and, you know, yelling at the AD on Twitter. I totally get the issue. But I just wish that there was another way to go about it. But here we are.
Yeah, I mean, I've discussed this a bunch of different times, just in terms of like how the schedule fixes everything. I think that, you know, the 20-game ACC schedule not only, you know, adds two games against an ACC team, but also adds another road game to the equation. So now you have the fact that Syracuse is so far away from most of the conference that they're going to need to find ways to keep an extra home game on there in non-conference play in order to use those gate receipts and fund some of that travel. I understand that the ACC has large payouts. The ACC network will only help that. Still, like, Syracuse is in a bit of a different position than a lot of the other teams in the conference, and a lot of the other teams in power conferences, save a few of the other geographic outliers as a product of the latest round of conference realignment. I think, you know, Jim Boeheim kind of went into this a little bit after the game, talking about, you know, you have 20 games accounted for in the ACC, you have the Big Ten ACC Challenge, that's 21. The games against Colgate and Cornell have pretty much become annual fixtures. That gets you to 23. And then you have the tournament that can involve Georgetown and or UConn, but gets you another two to three games, sometimes four, even if some of those are on your home court. So that brings you up to 26, 27 games. You don't really have a ton of wiggle room. And that's him being realistic about it. And it's not a cop out. It's complete reality, that we live in here. I think if Syracuse wants to up the level of difficulty, like I know we mock UConn and Georgetown, but like at their best, they are very historically capable programs, top 20-ish, top 25 at worst, but probably top 20 programs all time, and programs that most years, once they're, you know, at a reasonable level again, are only helping our resume. But yeah, I don't necessarily think you want to do that to your team, is have, you know, 10 ACC road games, add in every other year a road game against a Big Ten team, you know, add in every other year a road game against Georgetown or UConn or both. Like, that's a very challenging schedule, and again, one that completely ignores the financial you know, burden on Syracuse being a little bit further away from the rest of the ACC.
I really hope there's at least one UConn fan listening, because I know that the insinuation you just gave that UConn's like a top 20 to 25 program, when I know you actually meant Georgetown, is wonderful, and I support it.
I mean,
three titles since whatever. Tyler Olander, other things.
Yeah, yeah. I'll completely admit, I hate both of those programs with a passion. I will admit that both of them would absolutely be included in the top 20 or so programs of all time. I think Syracuse should be included over at least Georgetown. I think they should be included over UConn, because we haven't had the bad stretches.
I think you can make a very interesting debate between Syracuse and UConn. I think you can totally justify putting UConn ahead of Syracuse because they have the extra titles. I would say, if you say that you'd rather be Syracuse, or if you'd rather be UConn going forward, you are a crazy person.
Correct.
Yeah. I think you can totally justify saying that UConn has had a better run here, especially, I mean, like, obviously it's been shorter, but, like, they've won, what, 3 titles? So, yeah, great. Or 4 titles.
Yeah.
I don't care. I just don't. Like, just
your facts don't matter here.
But if you think that UConn has a better future in front of it than Syracuse basketball, you are a delusional person.
Oh, yeah, because the second he turns UConn back into a consistent winner, some Big Ten program's hiring Hurley.
Yes. Like, yes, Hurley is very susceptible. Yeah. You have to and that's the problem. Like, obviously, I don't know if they fired Ollie too quickly or not. The whole thing is very strange, probably. And the way they've handled the firing has been very, very second rate. And just really kind of gross to do that to an alumnus who won you a title. That being said, Ollie probably wouldn't have left unless it was for an NBA job where he, you know, he had his chance and stayed. And Hurley has no connections to the program, which is fine. Like, that was a really good hire. I think he's a good coach. That being said, like, the second, like, an Indiana opens up or something and he's, like, on the short list, like, he'll go. Sorry, UConn. Like, he will go. And that wouldn't happen to Syracuse, even if we hire an outside person after Boeheim. Like, so, yeah, that's the situation with them. Best of luck to them going forward this year. Help our not our RPI, help our net rating or whatever. And that's very useful. Thank you. Hopefully UConn does great things this year and then misses the tournament somehow in hilarious fashion, or Nick Toff for NCAA stuff, or makes the tournament and loses to someone embarrassing. I'm fine with all of these.
Oh, yeah, no, I want them and Georgetown to make the tournament and then proceed. Like, even, I don't even care if you get a top 8 seed. I don't give a shit. And, but I want you
Georgetown,
to lose.
Georgetown could, and then they'll, yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter who they play.
Yeah, I want you to lose in the most spectacular way possible. Casual Hoya promised that if they lose to a double digit seed again, that the blog will be shuttered. So I absolutely want this to happen as soon as possible.
Is that like a 1 year thing, or is that ever?
No, that seemed like ever. Based on the responses, I also think it's definitely happening again at some point.
I mean, we'll probably lose to a double digit seed at some point. I'm not going to say we should never have a website again.
Yeah, and especially given Georgetown's history here, seems like a bold stance to have.
Yeah, I mean, Georgetown's like, I mean, their greatest NCAA tournament win in recent history is that it's like Eastern Washington. So I don't know how sure we can be. I mean, they lose more often than not to double-digit seeds at this point.
Yeah, it's...
I guess Patrick Ewing has no history of it, but...
No, that's true. One last thing about this before we get to the actual Georgetown game a little bit. On the scheduling front, also bummed that this probably, the ACC expansion move in terms of games, probably eliminates any potential rivalry with Buffalo that might be developing. Now that the Bulls are suddenly like a top 50 program and maybe, you know, a lot more, but I'm not discrediting the Bulls by calling them top 50. I'm just saying that I'm not just looking at this year's team. I'm looking at the larger picture of programs and longer term viability, looking both backward and forward. And the Bulls have become that.
I'm fine with that. I mean, like, for mid-majors like that, like, it's very fleeting. We've seen it with, like, Siena, who was awesome for a stretch, and then McCaffrey went to Iowa, and now they've been kind of a train wreck.
Bulls have made, like, two great hires in a row, though, and they are actually recruiting, like, the last couple of years now, top 100-ish classes.
Oh, no, they've been very good. I just don't think it's ever going to be, like, a rivalry, because, like, A, punching down rivalries isn't fun, in my opinion, at least. Like, I don't love the idea of, like, having a rivalry, quote-unquote, with, like, a mid-major.
That's why Georgetown and UConn aren't fun.
Yeah, I mean, UConn's a mid-major already, and I want to keep that one going, and that's my exception. no, but, like, Buffalo, I'm like, happy for them. The fact they've had such a good year in football and basketball is impressive, and I'm totally cool playing them this year. I don't really care if we play them every year. That doesn't really matter to me. So, I mean, if they're going to be good for their schedule and it's a, you know, a fun local matchup, I have no problem playing it however often. I just don't really care if they fall off the schedule or not. So,
see, I just like the ability to never leave New York State and also challenge ourselves on the schedule a little bit.
And to get everyone very mad.
Yeah, and to get everyone very mad that we're not leaving, that we're basically just playing Wisconsin or Kentucky's schedule and just not leaving the state, but playing a better program.
Did that guy who didn't vote for Duke in the top 25 this week, did he vote for us?
I didn't look. I saw the nonsensical post and said, I'm not even going to entertain this.
I really hate how much we've had to defend Duke recently, but, like, it's so asinine. There's, like, no other good way to do it because it's the same exact argument that's been used against us for so long. And I don't really know why it just came to now that Duke, like...
This has been a regular thing for them.
Yeah, this is, I mean, and again, it's no different than us doing it, and it's not a big deal. Like, come on. Like, this is ridiculous.
This is the problem, with this quote-unquote rivalry with the Blue Devils is that I have too much respect for them to, like, actually completely disregard them as a program.
Oh, it's a different thing than UConn or Georgetown because it's way more fun to be dismissive of those two, while Duke is just really, really good all the time. And even this year, I don't think there are any of their players are super hateable because, like, Hayden Grayson was, like, obviously kind of possibly overplayed, but, like, it all came from a very real place.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the Duke one is definitely something of general respect just because of the Boeheim-Coach Tay relationship. The fact that, like, we've been kind of, like, the gritty underdog in that one, but we've also gotten them enough times where it's, like, it's fun to do it. I'm pretty happy with how the Duke series has gone so far because it's, like, usually pretty competitive. And even in our down years, like, we give them a hell of a run when we play, even at Cameron, so... Yeah, and that whole thing is so asinine. Like, if you don't want to put them number one, then don't. That's totally fine. They've lost. But, like, to not put them in the top 25 is so such a ridiculous attention grab. And, like, I guess he probably got what he wanted. But I also, like, it's one of those where, like, I don't really care if people are going to give him what he wants. Like, it is so stupid. Like, just shit on him however much you need to. Because it's like, ridiculous. That guy should not have a vote.
I would agree. All right. Now I promise we're going to talk about the actual Georgetown game. For those who didn't watch for some reason, and this is the first year ever hearing about what happened, my apologies. Syracuse looked like absolute garbage for much of the first half and parts of the second half. They were down 13 at halftime. It could have been more, really. They weren't shooting well. They were jacking up threes for reasons unknown. At one point, they were 1 for 13 from behind the arc. They ended up 8 for 28, which was better, but still only 29%, well, less than 29% on the game. Most of those were in the second half, including four from Elijah Hughes, which were great. Tyus Battle did almost nothing in the first half and then was a man on fire in the second half, including the final dagger with 2.8 to go to take a 72-71 lead. That final shot was really concerning me from Georgetown because it did look pretty good.
Especially because it came like 45 minutes after Teldon Johnson hit like the same shot from a little bit closer to center court. And it looked exactly the same from me off his hands and looking in the air for Kentucky and Seton Hall.
That looked very good. It was very concerning. I know Dylan Finer on the blog had a great article about should SU have fouled in the final minute. I was very much on team no foul, and I'm glad that the numbers didn't necessarily say it was unequivocally the best solution, but I'm glad that, A, it worked out for us, and, B, that the numbers said that it was – pretty much it was a slightly better option to not foul than to foul.
Yeah, I'm like usually fine with fouling, and the one thing I'm like, I trust Boeheim there because Boeheim has shown that he will foul. Like, he's come around on that, where a couple years ago I think he was still kind of a holdout. Yeah, but Boeheim I think kind of calls it on based on the flow of the game and what he feels is right in the moment. So I think we totally would have fouled if he thought it was the right thing to do. It just decided that he wanted to see it play out, and with how the second half had largely gone, I was fine with it.
Yeah, I mean, the defense played really well. Like, yes, Georgetown did score 36 in the second half, but I mean, if you look at what Syracuse did on offense, 50 points in the second half, like, you'll take allowing 36. I think that, you know, you didn't get bailed out by the Dolezal charge call against it by any means, but I think obviously, that helped a lot. That helped validate Boeheim's decision not to, you know, stop the clock sooner, potentially get Georgetown to the line. Like, on the game, Georgetown was 65% from the free throw line, so that's far from, like, perfect. But, you know, why make the game about hitting a three when you as a team weren't necessarily doing that all that well? Just, to me, I like the idea better of letting your shooters do what they're most comfortable with and most accurate doing. Obviously, Battle being one of the... I mean, Boeheim referred to Battle as maybe the clutch shooter in recent SU history. I think Jerry McNamara might have some issue with it, but I think Battle definitely takes the crown from the last decade or so.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jerry is the number one with a bullet, but I mean, I don't go far enough back where to remember like the 80s and 90s guys in terms of just clutch shooting. But since Jerry, I mean, what's the short list aside from
Devo?
Devo had obviously had some moments. I'm trying to think of someone who has like so
Johnny,
many. Of
Johnny
them.
Flynn had a few.
Yeah, I don't think they were like always in such obvious clutch moments as Battles. Battle Correct. Like. Hit so many game winners, game tires. Like, I mean, Dylan, who you brought up before, had like a really good thread on Twitter with like five or six from the last 3 years. And like, we're obviously only a couple games into this season. And I think he, I mean, just game winners and game tying shots down the stretch, he has like half a dozen already. And those aren't like things that happen all the time, especially in college basketball. You're playing, you know, 30 plus games a year. It's not like the NBA where you have 82 and in big moments often, like the game at Clemson, obviously the two or three of them already this season. Like, it's really impressive. Like, he's really built that rep, and he's so confident with it. And when he throws up one of those floaters, like, it, I'm always on board with him taking that shot if he has any kind of room. And he's been very good about creating separation. Now, before the play started, I tweeted, like, if Georgetown doesn't play triple team Battle here, I don't know what they're doing. Like, it's absurd that they would give him.
They didn't cover him at all.
No, they had like one guy on him, and they had like a soft double maybe. But he got a good 18 inches free and then threw up a largely open floater that he buried. And he's so good at that shot. And obviously, I think we were kind of thinking the same thing, Boeheim and company, because apparently the play was drawn up for Elijah Hughes. Boeheim says that. I don't totally believe it.
I don't buy that for a second.
Yeah. I don't believe it at all, but I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he meant, like, if Tyus isn't given the kind of soft opening he was given, like, you look for Elijah open because he might be the guy who the defense is lagging off of, but, like, come on. Battle's the number one option there 100% of the time. And then, yeah, if you have a wide-open Elijah Hughes, he's obviously probably our best three-point shooter. Like, you give him a look, but man, like, you can't do much better than what Tyus did in those last two shots. Like, he has such ice in his veins. He is completely unafraid to take that shot. And it just seems like he hits it most of the time. And after a pretty slow start to the year, he's really rounded into the player we've looked for, even from the efficiency. Like, this wasn't the most efficient game, but he was 26 on 18 shots. Like, that's obviously the Northeastern game. He was pretty bad, but we didn't really need him to be much more than that. He only scored 2 points and only played 27 minutes. But Cornell, 26 on 17 shots, 20 on only 10 shots since Ohio State, 24 on 10 shots since Colgate. Like, this is kind of what we were looking for, which obviously he struggled early on, especially when Frank was out. And I still think the impact Frank has made has gone a bit under, maybe not underreported, but I think it's very easy to look at Frank's raw numbers and say he hasn't been playing well. But the team just looks like totally different since he's come back. And I think Tyus might be the main beneficiary of that.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. And I think, yeah, you're right. Battle, you know, we talked about this a little bit last week. Battle kind of is the rare person to come back and seemingly address some of the things that NBA scouts had some issue with. I think that having him be able to take over a game, and, you know, Boeheim kind of lit a fire under his ass at halftime, and he really did respond, and he looked like a veteran leader here. I mean, if you have that clutch gene, and it's not really quantifiable necessarily, but, like, if you have it, you know, you'll get work in the NBA. I mean, you might not be, you know, a guy who makes every All-Star team, but you could be really good. I mean, look at a guy like Jamal Crawford, like, and I mean, J.R. Smith at his height, like, guys like that who just really were great knockdown jump shooters, and were able to take over portions of games. Like, they didn't have to be all world, they didn't have to be all stars all the time. Like, but you can make a really good living doing that. One other player I'll mention before we get to halftime, on that front in terms of clutch, in a very small sample size, John Gillen. Don't want
yeah,
to
John had a bunch.
He had a bunch.
John was
like
an interesting one because he was only here
Duke,
for a year.
But the Duke game, on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah, just absolutely lethal. He was somebody who, he was not known for being a shooter by any means, but he was on that team at least, the guy that you wanted the ball in his hands with the clock running down.
It was so funny because, like, throughout the year, he would bounce between, like, almost not being in the rotation in some games to, like, having about the NC State game where he scored like 40 points.
One of the greatest scoring outputs in Syracuse history.
Yeah. And then, like, a couple of games later, he was, like, playing like 8 minutes because we couldn't have him on defense. But yeah, he had some miraculous shots that year. on one of the weirder Syracuse teams in recent vintage.
I would agree. All right. I think that's a good place to head to halftime. So, Dan, what have you been drinking of late?
I've had a decent amount of new stuff and stuff, not so new stuff, but stuff I don't have all the time. I think we've recorded, so only a couple different things since last week. I had a bunch of Green City from Other Half, obviously one of the more well-regarded breweries here in New York, and they do some really, really good IPA work. Green City is delicious, super drinkable, so I had a couple of those the other night. I think maybe the only totally new thing I had, which has been out before, I just haven't had it before, is the Dean Mahogany Pale Ale from Single Cup, which is a really interesting kind of full-bodied brown ale, but also quite drinkable, has like kind of an amber thing going on as well, but does have like a nice pale ale kind of citrusy flavor as well. It's a really nice blend of styles, I think. And then I had some Post Red Pumpkin. I think I also had something from Trove's. I forgot to mark it down. But yeah, some not a huge selection, but so a bunch of some different good things. So
very nice. Yeah, I actually drank some wine last Friday, so nothing to report there, at least in terms of our podcast and its usual scope. But for the rest of the weekend, did have a few different things. Modern Times, I had their Bedrock Brown Ale. It was a nitro brown ale with coffee and coconut. It was a really, really good drink. Had 18 Monks, a double IPA from Monkish, with 18th Street Brewing out this way. That was kind of, had like sea salt, some orange, a whole bunch of other things going on. It was an interesting beer. Had Little Bo Pills from Smog City, a favorite of mine that I mentioned here and there. Also picked up some cans over at Monkish for the first time in a while, because I randomly drove over to pick up a bottle, and there wasn't a line for cans for once, so was able to pick up a couple things. But got Spocket, their latest IPA that they had in cans there. I'll probably give that another week and a half or so. With the hazier stuff, I do find that like it usually ages. I mean, you don't want to age it forever, because that's like the opposite of what you would do with an IPA, but you wait a week and a half, I think it starts to settle really well container-wise. And then also had a Firestone Lager, which I just have a 12-pack that's sitting in the fridge, because it's a great kind of on-hand beer whenever you're either having people over or just sitting and relaxing.
So I might be reacting to old-ish news, although let's say it's in the last hour, but I'm not working today, so I usually try to stay off the internet because I will drive myself crazy if I'm there all the days of the week. Chris Klieman to North Kansas State, NDSU's coach.
Huh. I mean, that's an interesting move. I wouldn't make it.
You wouldn't make it on his part or on their part?
Well, no, on his part.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the money's going to be better, but like, I don't know. Like, Fargo's kind of cool. Like,
he's 51, so it's not super old, but I think like the FCS has become less of an obvious jumping off point for coaches.
Right.
I mean, we've seen really, like, really prominent FCS coaches have to go to, like, mid-majors, or not mid-majors, group of fives. So I think Kansas State, it's an interesting job. I think it's people don't understand how hard a job it can be, because Bill Snyder's literally the only successful coach they've had in 30 years, right. And that's over the course of three different 10 years, with the Ron Prince debacle in between his two. So I think getting a really established, like, knows how exactly to run a program guy like Klieman, there's definitely some there's something to that, and he's from the area generally. He's from Iowa. He played at Northern Iowa. He coached at Kansas previously. But yeah, it's definitely interesting. It will definitely be a risk for him. I thought the Seth Luttrell hire on their part would have been pretty good, but it seems like he had second thoughts there, and he might be holding off for a slightly bigger job. But it'll be really interesting to see if the second go-around replacing Snyder does well, because I think Kansas State isn't that much of an easier job than Kansas, if at all, to be honest.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, it might be harder, if only because, like, that JUCO, that vaunted JUCO pipeline, like, still needed to be coached up. So if the right coach isn't there to take on that type of structure, I don't necessarily know if it works. I mean, I like him. I like the hire. I don't, if I were him, I don't know if I'd make this jump. at least not now, especially when like there's probably going to be other jobs in the middle plains to western part of the United States coming open the next year or two, and NDSU isn't going anywhere either. Also kind of speaks volumes about the job at K-State that like Venables isn't interested. And that probably, at least to me, I mean, maybe you disagree, I think it does kind of close the door on Venables going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah, I'm getting the sense of, I mean, I'm not the only one, but I get the sense that Venables might just be a life for DC, which is fine. I think that's, I think people overrate, like, taking
stepping
a head
coaching up,
job,
right.
That's what's what you're supposed to do, versus, like, if you're happy being a defensive coordinator and you don't want the, you know, the challenge of becoming a head coach, if you know that's not right for you and you don't want what that entails, I think it's totally fine to be a DC forever if you're really good at it. And we've seen that with Venables. We've seen it with a couple other guys, especially on the defensive side of the ball, where obviously offense is so in vogue in hiring right now. So, yeah, I'm not sold that he wants a head coaching job at all, which is fine.
Yeah, I would agree. All right, pivoting from that to Syracuse football, a couple quick notes before we get to this getting rid of divisions idea. Great news, Andre Schmidt and Andre Sisco both made the AP All-American team, as well as multiple other All-American teams. Schmidt was first team, SU's first teamer since 2001 when Dwight Freeney made it as a unanimous selection. Andre Sisco was a third team selection after tying for the national lead in interceptions on the year. Two All-Americans. I was looking, I can't find, like, without really digging into each and every All-American list, the last time SU had two All-Americans on any of the teams in one season. It's just great to see that, you know, Dino Babers just came in and promised a higher level of competition, a more respectable program year in and year out, higher level of recruiting, of just talent in general. And, like, you look at what's happened here. The last three seasons now, we've had at least one All-American. This is the first time we've had a first-teamer under Babers. But, yeah, having Ahmed Atawa in 2016, Steve Ishmael last year, and now having two players, neither of which on the offensive side of the football, I think speaks probably the biggest volumes, and it's an underrated part of all this, that Babers, an offensive coach, is able to have two non-offensive players be All-Americans this season and still set records on offense nonetheless.
You know what's really funny, too, is, like, all four players that have made All-American lists in these 3 years under Babers are all from radically different backgrounds in terms of how they came to be a Babers player. You have Ahmed Atawa, who was an interesting transfer that we were like, oh, he might be a nice contributor, and blew up. You have Steve Ishmael, who he inherited from, he was not even a Schaefer, I think. Was he a Schaefer recruit, or was he a Marone recruit that before Marone left? I can't remember.
He was a Schaefer guy. Because he was on the 2014 team, and he was Schaefer guy, but not like but he wasn't a highly touted Schaefer guy.
He was pretty highly touted, I think.
I mean, he was highly touted in terms of like guys that we get or got in the past.
Yeah, he was like a Florida guy who didn't get like the giant Florida offers, right, but had offers from like everywhere else.
Yeah.
And then you have Sisto, who is obviously a Babers recruit. And then you have Andre Schmidt, who was literally a walk-on that just won the job and went off to, like, not miss a kick for most of the year and, like, missed a couple weird kicks down the stretch, but was still, you know, he won the DeRosa for a reason. Like, I don't think anyone can really argue with him. I know like, Georgia fans are really mad about Blankenship not making the finalist list a couple weeks ago, and then he went off and missed a bad kick, I think, the next week.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, none of those kickers were absolutely perfect this year, so Schmidt was just as worthy as Paul Tracy or the guy from Wyoming. But he's just been money for, like, 95% of the season. So for him to make first team is awesome. So you have four guys, like, from pretty much every possible way of adding a player to your football team as a new coach. Like, he kind of ran the gambit, which is impressive because you have guys he coached up. You have guys who he identified through regular recruiting, through the walk-on process, which is crazy, and through the transfer market.
Agreed. In other football news, people probably saw this late last week. Will Grier is the biggest name that will not be playing for West Virginia as he prepares for the draft. That obviously very much impacts what the ears are going to do in this game. I think that it doesn't seal a loss for West Virginia, but if I'm a Mountaineer fan, I'm not really banking on a win at this point. Jack Allison's not a bad player as his backup, but he has such limited experience. Just 10 passes this year, completed 6 of them for 75 yards, 1 touchdown, 1 interception. That's really not the sort of extensive time out there that that you would want in a replacement looking to beat a 9-3 team in a bowl game. Dan, does this upgrade in your head at least this game to a Syracuse win with I mean, I wouldn't say no trouble, but a whole lot less trouble?
I mean, definitely a whole lot less. I'm not going to say like it's a slam dunk. Obviously, West Virginia is very good. I thought we were getting a little underrated in this game to begin with, mostly because I thought there was a very good chance of this exact thing happening. I saw right after the game was announced, I think Syracuse is like a plus 220 underdog, so I was happy to take that, put a couple dollars on that with the possibility of Greer sitting out. What was the line down to, like us plus one now or even plus even?
I thought it was plus one or plus two. I haven't looked though in like 24
after
hours.
It was like seven and a half,
right?
Which was a lot. I thought that was too many for West Virginia to begin with, but there was always going to be, I think, maybe not for every West Virginia player, but for like the team as a whole, I think there was a good chance of there being an enthusiasm gap between us and West Virginia, where this is our biggest game in a long time. Eric Dungy's playing in his last game, and he doesn't have the same NFL, not aspirations, but doesn't have the same, like, you know, he's not a possible first-round pick. So he's, you know, this game could be huge for him in terms of making the NFL versus Greer, who has had a really good two seasons and has kind of shown what he needs to show. So I totally get it on his part, especially after his left tackle decided that he was not going to play. And if you're Greer, like, when you have Alton Robinson on the other side and Chris Slayton and your left tackle's not playing, I'm okay with this decision on his part. Like,
oh, yeah.
If you're going to play, you want to have your full complement of protection there. You don't want to get hurt. So I'm totally fine with his decision in terms of, like, as a neutral observer. Anyway, I mean, as close to a neutral observer as I can be, I get it. And I would have gotten it if Eric Dungy was in the same spot, and he decided he wanted to play in this game. Like, I understand this full stop. Like, it's fun to be in these bowl games. They're big for more some teams more than others, and I think we're on that side this year. But ultimately, like, they are kind of exhibitions. They can kind of set the stage for the following season, but they don't make everything. So, yeah, it's hard to really fault these guys, and it's hard to fault them if they want to play, and they're putting, you know, themselves at risk. Like, you have to let these players make their own decisions, and Greer did that. So it seemed like most West Virginia fans were handling it pretty well. Obviously, there's always people on both sides of this thing, people calling it a quitter and whatnot. But ultimately, like, I get it, and Syracuse is definitely the benefactor. It doesn't mean we're going to necessarily go in there and win. Jack Allison will probably try to have, like, some amazing game to lock up that that starting job next season. But, you know, we still have to go out there and play, and I think our team will be highly motivated either way.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think that this has any effect on how psyched Syracuse is or isn't. I feel like Syracuse players understand what this game means to the program, what it means to Babers, what it means to their legacies, Dungy in particular, and what it means to, you know, SU fans and the folks who have been through, you know, all these rougher seasons. Like, this is, this now has the opportunity, and we talked about this last week, we talked about it on Twitter, like, this has the opportunity to be that turnaround where you look back and go, oh man, Syracuse won 10 games that year. They finished, you know, top 15. They, like, this was the year that everything turned around, potentially. So I think that they all get that, and Babers is going to coach them up accordingly. So I think they had a really good shot to beat West Virginia with everyone playing. I think now even more so. We'll see if David Sills ends up sitting out too, because if he decides that he's not going, that really does take away most of the firepower, at least the biggest names firepower for this West Virginia team.
Yeah, and I saw some people on the Syracuse side saying, like, now people aren't going to take Syracuse winning this game. Is who cares?
Nobody will care. Like, yeah, like 2 weeks from now, nobody will care.
That's the most asinine thing I've seen in a long time. People are not going to remember that Will Greer didn't play in this game. And honestly, like, except for Syracuse fans and West Virginia fans, and if West Virginia fans, if we win this game like 45-20 or something, and West Virginia fans want to say, well, actually, in like 3 years, like,
please refer to the three previous games.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, no one cares. Like, we're not going to not get credit for winning this game and winning 10. The only thing people are going to look back and say, oh, that was the year that Syracuse won 10 games under Dino Babers, and that was, like, kind of a jumping-off point for them. They're not going to say, yeah, but they won 9, but Will Greer didn't play. in the bowl game. So really, they probably would have been nine. No, that's not going to happen. So yeah, like, come on, like, people, you have to like strain to remember who did and didn't play in their bowl game at this point. Christian McCaffrey didn't. Leonard Fournette didn't. But if you told me, I'm trying to think of like a similar like level player from like the last 2 years, if they played or not, I probably wouldn't be able to tell you with any certainty, unless it was in the playoff, which obviously people aren't skipping the playoff games.
Right. And that's the thing. Like, you know, there's all these stupid columns now about like, oh, like it completely like diminished the Bulls. Like, yeah, it diminished the Bulls only in the sense that like they mattered a little bit less, but like, the bowl games still matter to the fans of the teams. They still matter to a lot of the players. Like, and yeah, I've said this before. I don't blame any player for protecting their future earnings by making a smart business decision here. Like, you were unpaid labor for several years now. Like, make the decision that's going to allow you to make the most as paid labor going forward. Like, this is a no-brainer decision if you're a guy like Greer. And like you said, once your left tackle's out, like, okay, like, there goes any chance for me to play, because I don't want to endanger the rest of my career. It's risk assessment. And like, all the people sitting around, you know, on message boards and Twitter criticizing, like, you would make similar assessments of risk in your own career about what you were and weren't going to do, and you just don't have an audience watching you do it. So I think that, you know, this is a smart move by Greer. It's a smart move by other players that choose to do it. And like we both said, nobody's going to remember who sat out and who didn't, because, you know, if you pulled up the top 25 standings at the end of last year right now, I wouldn't be able to tell you who played in any of those bowl games or whether or not any of those, you know, 8, 9, 10 win teams, quote unquote, deserved that win total or not, because I don't care.
Yeah, we also don't know how, like, Jack Allison to go out there and throw for 500 yards in him stuff, and you and maybe he would have been, you know, the better option there, because Greer would have been playing, worried about getting hurt. Or, like, you know, if Geno Smith didn't play in the last West Virginia bowl game, would West Virginia have been better off or worse off? Like, who? It doesn't seem like it probably had a major impact. So, like, you can't just say, like, this X didn't happen, therefore, like, Y doesn't matter, because, like, these things are all very variable. And it's just dumb. Like, enjoy the win. If Syracuse gets 10 wins, it's a huge, huge impact. And the thing you're looking for isn't to win one Camping World Bowl. You're looking to build something that can last for years on end, and that we won't like drift into the morass of the G-Rob through and Schaefer years and half of the Marone years. Like, you're and even the first two Babers years. You're building something where, you know, 10 wins is not like this crazy breakout season. It's like the thing we do every so often, and that's what you get with like winning a nice bowl game. Like, you're building to a thing. You're not just, it's not all about winning this one game against this one quarterback. So yeah, that whole thing was really annoying. People look for reasons not to get excited about something. Like, we're Syracuse. This isn't our problem at all. It is completely not our problem whether or not Will Greer wants to play in this game or not.
I completely agree. I guess one last note on football before we wrap up for today. I mentioned it before. The Big Ten is thinking about getting rid of divisions, or at least they're considering the idea after being left out of the playoff two straight years. It doesn't occur to them that the main reason that happened was because, well, main reasons. A, you expanded to 9 games, which automatically makes your schedule tougher in a sport where the entire goal is not to lose, which I've preached for years. Why would you do that? And then the second one being that your best team got blown out by Iowa 1 year and then got blown out by Purdue the other. And that's the reason why you didn't end up in the playoff. Like, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. The lesson is, if you're going to lose one game, don't make it by like 30 points on the road at a decent but not great Big Ten West team. Like, that is the mantra. Like, Clemson has lost games before to us. In a close game at the Dome, and to Pitt, I think that was at home, but it was by like a field goal, and it didn't cost them the playoff because it wasn't a national embarrassment.
Right. Yeah.
Like, when Clemson lost to us, the story was us. When Ohio State lost to Purdue and Iowa, the story was
Ohio State shit the bed.
Ohio State just got absolutely demolished.
Yeah, I don't really understand. I mean, I'm fine with it because Jim Delaney was the biggest hurdle towards complete deregulation of conference championship games and complete self-determination towards deciding you know, how those teams get selected. So if the Big Ten decides to do this, and I know somebody mentioned this on Twitter, and sorry I don't have your username up, but they were laughing about if the Big Ten ends up getting rid of divisions after adding Maryland and Rutgers just to increase an Eastern wing. Just highly ironic.
I think Delaney actually, was it Delaney or was someone else at the Big Ten who basically like admitted adding Rutgers was a bad idea? Like, he didn't say that, but someone asked about like if Maryland and Rutgers were like still worth it or something along those lines. I'm not, you know, direct quoting, so I forget what it
they
was.
Are not worth it.
And he was basically like, I think Maryland has a lot of potential.
Yeah, those Scarlet Knights.
Chris Ash, 2019, baby.
Yeah,
let's go.
That's going to be fun. I also think that, like, I'm fine if Chris Ash sticks around forever, especially for those 2020 and 2021 games that we have against Rutgers. Because that'll just be, I mean, I think we can beat them either way, but it's much more fun to beat a hapless Rutgers team that we can then, you know, scoop up New Jersey recruits and all kinds of other nonsense.
Yeah, I'm definitely on team, like, let's root for Rutgers to have, like, a real nice upswing five-win year next year.
Oh, yeah, because that'll be like, yeah, because
things are building on the banks of the, I forget what river that is, but on those banks, on the banks, things are building. The Raritan River.
just give me that 5-win season that says we can't fire him because things are getting
five
better.
Wins with, like, an upset of Michigan State and, like, they gave Penn State a real run.
Yeah, they beat Maryland and Indiana.
Yeah, this is perfect. And then who do they have? I'm actually going to look up Rutgers' non-conference schedule. Maybe, well, let's find the five wins, let's optimize Rutgers' 5-7 season.
Yikes. This is probably the lowest this show's ever gotten.
Next year they have UMass. So that's a win. At Kinnick. They're not winning at Kinnick.
Nope.
BC.
Beat the dudes.
Oh, that'd be really funny. At Michigan, maybe like lose by 10, because Michigan loves to run it up on Rutgers.
Right.
So lose by 10, that's a feel good. Then they host Maryland.
Beat
so
Maryland. Beat Indiana.
At Indiana. And then they have Minnesota at home.
Lose to Minnesota. You beat Liberty and you beat Illinois. You could get the 6 wins on this schedule without much effort.
Not that bad a schedule. And then they lose the last 3, but like no, it won't be too bad. That's a brutal way to finish the year.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's miserable. No, but seriously, they could win 6 games. Like,
oh,
like,
yeah, I mean, honestly, like...
Like, a bad Rutgers team could be, like, a fringe top 25 receiving votes team because the first 9 games of the schedule are a joke, other than Michigan.
I mean, the only games you can really count them out of are at Iowa and at Michigan. And even at Iowa, like, like, Iowa at night is tough, like, really tough. We've seen that over the years, but, like, they also can lay an egg.
Yeah, they've done dumb shit. They've lost to North Dakota State a couple times.
Yeah, so that's not like I'm just assuming that Iowa will be like this, like 8-win Iowa that we've had the last couple of years. So I won't count on that. And then at Michigan, like Michigan loves to blow out Rutgers, so they probably won't win that one. But they can win all these other games. I assume they won't win all of them. They can win 5 of them. And like, you know, then you're like, all right, peace building things. They look better. Yeah, this year wasn't that. So yeah, we'll root for that. I don't really want Rutgers to make a bowl, but I'm fine with them like showing enough to keep Chris Ash around for 2020.
Same, yeah. Get me the 5-7, but like let us still win 8 games so that we continue to have like recruiting superiority, and then yeah, then we can lay waste to them in 2020.
Oh, we play Monmouth and that's them. Never mind, I'm an idiot. I was reading their schedule because I haven't changed the page, but they play Monmouth before us. I was gonna say if we play Monmouth and then Rutgers, like we gotta like. Claim the shore.
Just plant a flag somewhere on the beach. You know, do it on the boardwalk and then just like walk away. DeVito shows up.
Oh yeah, we also have Tommy DeVito. We are taking the Jersey Shore is ours, beginning in 2020.
Tommy DeVito is going to be a senior. the final year of the 2-year Rutgers.
Tommy DeVito's going to walk around Syracuse with no shirt on the entire year unless he's playing a game.
I'll mail him a gym tan and laundry T-shirt. Just Jim Tan and laundering Rutgers.
Oh God, so good.
Oh God. Anyway, the thing we're actually going to talk about, the divisions. So people might remember, like 2.5 years ago, I wrote up an article in the height of the off season about how to go to 3 permanent rivals and a rotating schedule from there. people might have some issues with the three permanent rivals I selected for everyone. That's fine. I think for the older teams, it's less debatable. I think for the newer teams, and that's like half the conference at this point, there is some debate to be had in the ACC about who those three games are, but I think there's also a lot less wiggle room for them to decide who those three games are. It doesn't necessarily help matters in terms of integrating the newer members with the older members, but if you only have three teams locked in every year, you have another five that you would face just on a rotating basis. So for Syracuse, I proposed at the time and still propose now, BC, Pitt, Louisville every year. You'd face two of those at home, one of them away, and then rotate. And then the other five games, in even years, I had said Clemson, Miami, NC State, VaTech, Wake Forest, so that would have been this year's schedule. And in the odd years, SU would face Duke, Florida State, Georgia Tech, UNC, and Virginia. So you'd be able to rotate home and away. You'd get to go to every venue in the league every 4 years, so every player conceivably, if you stayed for four seasons, would be able to do that. And same goes for all the other teams here. Like, it's just a... it's a better solution. I think it's better than pods, if only because pods are usually like a four-team deal. There's some unevenness. You're still tied to a couple other teams, and the pods kind of force you to do a little more finagling. I feel like with this, makes it pretty easy to visualize just how you'd be able to face all the teams. And there's no like, oh, well, what about ties between pod one and pod three? Like, I even applied the potential tiebreakers to previous years where they were necessary, and we never had to go to a college football playoff ranking as a tiebreaker. In all of these, I was able to use head-to-head or record versus common opponents to decide all of these matchups.
Yeah, I'm in favor of something like this. Like, I don't mind the pod idea that Bill Connolly has proposed. Obviously, there are some downsides, but it adds another rival. I think that's more important for some of the other leagues than it is for the ACC, but like, there are very few teams that have like four plus teams they want to play every year. And honestly, like, I'm sure there'll be some complaining, but like, you have to just weigh like the pros and cons. Like, if you're losing one every year rivalry, you're still playing that team every 2 years, and
it's better than now when you're facing them every six.
Yeah, when you're facing everyone on the other side aside from your crossover every six. So like, what's one of the main games we sacrifice doing this, like, every year?
Wake Forest.
Not us particularly, but, like, in the ACC. Like,
what's one of the big annual games that goes away, well, not even an annual game. We just used to be annual game that goes away. Like, UNC Wake Forest doesn't happen every year here. It just happens every other year.
Okay, so are either of those fan bases that mad about that? Like, I'm sure there's a section that's, like, but even right now, the North Carolina teams are split up. Like, and I know, like, they have crossovers, but, like,
well, UNC and Wake are so mad about it that they scheduled a non-conference game for next year.
I forgot they did that.
It's just like such a dumb, still super dumb, and they're just going to play it anyway.
And honestly, I don't even mind, like, it's weird and dumb, but if you want to do that in this new setup, I'm fine with that too, if that's going to get you over the hump.
I feel like NC State fans were annoyed that they were missing out on the Textile Bowl from this arrangement, which, like, sure, I guess, but like, I feel like State values at least Duke and UNC more. Or, like, I mean, I guess the Wake Forest game doesn't really matter, but, like, I don't want to put Wake Forest on an island where they only end up facing, you know, two of the other. Like, if you get rid of NC State, Wake Forest could end up facing, like, one, maybe, of the other North Carolina schools, and I don't want to make them, like, a forgotten son of the Carolinas in this regard. So, I don't know. I think, like I said to a lot of people, I appreciated all the love thrown it on Twitter today. I think that there's some easy ways to tweak this a little bit, but I think the basic, what you take away from it is that the bones of it are correct in that this is something easy to plug in, and not just for the ACC, but also for other conferences. That's a little bit simpler than pods and does really make it a clean look at the entire conference and accommodating a 14-team league.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely a big step up. Like, we outlined the problem with the divisions all the time. It's just you want to have a more unified conference, and that's what this helps feel like. And honestly, like, especially if you can get every team playing in Florida every 2 years and every player playing, seeing every venue, like, I think that's just a good goal to have. And if you want to accommodate some other teams by, like, allowing them to do the weird UNC Wake Forest thing, I think that's on them. That's fine. It just won't count to our conference standings. And, like, there are so few of those issues that, whatever. Like, let them do what they want. If they want to sacrifice one of their non-cons, that's totally cool. But, yeah, something like this, something along these lines, that just gets us to the end game of, like, everyone playing everyone more often and protecting the few major rivalries that actually need to be protected, I'm all for.
Yeah, and, like, I even, when I put this together, I even, like, kind of paired potential opponents together. So you'll see, like, Virginia Tech and Virginia don't necessarily appear on a lot of team schedules. That was on purpose. Split the Carolina schools as much as possible. Miami and Florida State are split as much as possible. Georgia Tech and Clemson are, too. Like, even SU and BC, I tried to split them up as much as I could just for the sake of avoiding two, like, Northeast trips in 1 year. Or too much exposure there. So, like, this is, again, not completely perfect. You could tweak some things as needed, but this does find balance. And that I think, is the biggest demand on any model like this. And I think, you know, the biggest sacrifice here is really that you just don't play every year against some teams. But I'm sure Clemson would be fine not playing us or Wake Forest every year. I'm sure Virginia Tech would rather play, you know, just guarantee games against, you know, I mean, they already had these, but games against Virginia and Georgia Tech and Miami every year, and then have more trips to Syracuse and Boston College and Florida State and all these schools that they don't necessarily get to play every year. Louisville could be a potential, you know, long-term rival with Virginia Tech based on numerous factors around their football programs and, you know, academic profiles and fan bases. Like, that there's a lot of things that can be birthed here that the current structure isn't going to allow for and will never allow for because of how infrequently we face one another.
Yeah, I just don't really get, aside from, like, people who just need things very simple and like to know, like, these are our six division rivals, this is who it will always be, and I have seen a little bit of that in the past, like, aside from that very strange standpoint, I don't see how you really argue against this being an upgrade. And then it also, you know, we haven't even gone into, it allows for a, like most years, probably a better conference title game.
Surprisingly, the ACC didn't change as much as you would think it would.
Yeah, this is like, I think we've had like the weird Florida State down years plus Clemson's dominance.
Right. Yeah. To be honest, only 7 of the 14 years changed. That's half. But they didn't, the only year that it would absolutely be fundamentally different was 2006, actually. The tiebreaker that I had in place for head-to-head actually eliminated Wake Forest from the title game that year completely. So you would have to remove the random Orange Bowl appearance and the random, you know, largely Jeopardy question-ish Wake Forest 2006 championship. But yeah, 2005 would change from Florida State, Virginia Tech to Virginia Tech, Miami. 2006 would have changed from Wake Forest, Georgia Tech to Georgia Tech, Va Tech. 2008 would have been BC, Georgia Tech instead of BC, Virginia Tech. 2009 would have been Georgia Tech, Virginia Tech instead of Clemson, Georgia Tech. 2012 and 2013 would have been Florida State and Clemson. And then 2016 would have been Clemson, Louisville instead of Clemson, Virginia Tech. So, like, I don't think anyone's really, other than Wake Forest fans, I don't think anyone's, like, fundamentally, like, opposed to, like, those changes that really did create better matchups. And, like, if you look at the historical scores, for a whole bunch of years in a row, like, the ACC title game was actually a pretty tight matchup, despite any perceived rankings gulf between the two schools.
Yeah, I think that's all good. I think the ACC would be better off, even if, like, the games are usually tight, I think the ACC would be better off with the chance of a Florida State Clemson or a Miami-Florida State rematch or, like, something that gets two of the name opponents in there. And obviously, like, this year wouldn't have changed it, like, your thing doesn't get us in, but, like, overall, I mean, based on how we project things out, but, like, overall, you want to have your two best teams in there, even if it's at the expense of possibly a Syracuse. Like, I think you generally want to have your two best representatives. You want to make it a big game on a big stage, and, like, this year just didn't get there. No offense to Pitt, like, they deserve their spot, but it just, like, we weren't getting what was probably best for the league. And that was also because ACC was down this year. But, like, when you have a matchup like that, it really sells the inequality in the league, which is not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah, and admittedly, like I said, my exercise just replicated it since Pitt had a very coastal-heavy even-year slate, and we had both Clemson and Pitt in our. So if you took the real-world results, it didn't change anything. Both teams were 6-2, and Pitt still would have won the tiebreaker and made it somehow. I didn't really, but that's also assuming like that nothing else changed. I didn't go through the entire schedule for every other team. So there's a potential that, you know, that alters some other things a bit with those schedules. But, you know, I think that if the Big Ten's willing to consider it, then it becomes a little more reality. ACC is only a first mover when it comes to conference realignment. They're never a first mover when it comes to thinking a little more radically around around structure and around scheduling. Big Ten is one step. If the SEC starts talking about it, I think the ACC would actually jump at something like this, even if this specific outline probably seems a little too radical for like athletic administrators to get behind, because they would never think of it themselves.
Yeah, the problem is like the ACC, like you said, doesn't move. Like the Big Ten kind of does its own thing, and the ACC usually follows the SEC's lead for the most part.
Right.
But the advantage here is that it doesn't impact the ACC-SEC crossover rivalries, the Louisville and Kentucky's, the Clemson, South Carolina, Florida State, etc. So I think there's a chance that, like, if the Big Ten does it, there might be a little bit of an emboldening. And obviously it seems like, I feel like when the thoughts become this public, and are like openly discussed, except for a Big 12 expansion the last time around, these things end up happening.
Yeah, I agree, and I guess we'll see what happens. I don't think anything that would happen probably wouldn't for another 2 years at least, but I said this is the start of a potential conversation.
Yep, I'm happy. I'm weirdly happy with Jim Delaney saying a thing. That's very rare.
Too true. All right, Dan, anything else this week? I feel like we got to cover a lot.
No, we got bowls coming up at the end of the week, and then, you know, we have a bit of a lull here for Syracuse until ACC playing basketball and the big game on the 28th, so exciting times. But, yeah, I don't think we have another huge... Oh, Buffalo. Buffalo's good. Buffalo on the 18th.
That's right.
St. Bonnie's on the 29th.
ODU on Saturday.
ODU on Saturday. Are they good? I don't even know.
They're not bad. I mean, they're like a fringe, like almost CUSA representative last year.
Let's see, 7-3. They played UNI twice, weirdly. Split those. They lost to Oregon State close. They lost to St. Joe's not so close. They beat VCU. And VCU, I think, beat Texas.
Yeah, they're fine. I mean, they're not amazing, but they're fine.
Yeah, it's a solid opponent. So, yeah, we'll get a nice team on Saturday. And then a weirdly big matchup against Buffalo on, I guess, Tuesday?
Yep.
Arkansas State's not always, is always, like, pretty decent. St. Bonnie's have been pesky. And then we have the ACC. So, yeah, actually a relatively interesting, if not, like, great name brand run down the stretch here in the non-conference schedule.
Yeah, that's totally fine with me. I think the more we can do stuff like this, the better. And it'll be interesting to see what we deal with this next year. Dan, appreciate your time as always. It's been another fun one.
Yep, thanks for having me.
Of course. Everyone, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. You can rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, on wherever else you listen to your podcasts. And go Orange.
Go Orange.